I'm Stephanie Begun. I am a third-year doctoral student at the University of Denver Graduate School of Social Work. And I'm here on the behalf of a very large research team who has worked on this particular study, in which our overarching goal was to help understand how to help homeless youth better detect risk so they can stay safer on the street. So the principal investigator is my mentor. She couldn't be here today. That's Dr. Kimberly Bender, who is also at the University of Denver. And for any of you who have ever tried to do particularly a randomized trial, but any large research study, it takes a lot of people. So there are a lot of people listed here as well as on our acknowledgments page, which I will get to in a bit. But thanks so much for having us here, and we're all excited to be a part of this this great conference. So I have no relationships to disclose. And as some context for the current study, sort of backing it up, we did a previous multi-site study in which there were 601 homeless youth interviewed across three different samples, Denver, Austin, Texas, and Los Angeles. And in that, we found really, I think, every time I see these, I think they're really staggering percentages. A very large number of the homeless youth we interviewed had experienced childhood physical abuse, childhood emotional abuse, and or childhood sexual abuse. And the rates that we found were very much reflected in broader literature that had been done on this topic or had been conducted on this topic in the past. We also asked them if they had experienced victimization while on the streets, and a large number, these are the percentages, for example, in Denver, 83% that they had experienced direct street victimization, and 78% had experienced indirect street victimization, so that's witnessing an assault or being a bystander to some sort of suspicious or dangerous activity. And then of the 601 that I referred to, youth who were quantitatively or survey interviewed, about 150 of them as a subsample were interviewed qualitatively, just to ask them a little bit more about how they detect risk. And this was a combination of both internal or affective sort of responses, like, oh, I just feel kind of weird, there's something going on that just doesn't feel right, I get bad vibes. As well as external cues, reading people, someone's acting really creepy or suspicious, I just kind of get the sense that something's not right with this other person. But then a high number of the time, it seemed that risk can happen anytime, anywhere, as though it's undetectable and it's just something that we can't necessarily prevent or detect. It's sort of at random. So that led us, that worried us for a lot of reasons, because among homeless youth, a history of trauma increases risk for experiencing subsequent victimization. And youth with histories of trauma in general often fail to detect risks, making them highly vulnerable to subsequent victimization. Victimization, unfortunately, is a predictor of future re-victimization. And this group, because of these histories of trauma and victimization, often have a more difficult time reasoning about social contracts and precautionary problems, but they don't make mistakes on abstract reasoning. So that kind of indicates that there might be a mechanism that this is something that can be taught or sort of reframed through intervention. The trauma and victimization also leads to difficulties with holding attention and memory and inhibition, which all of those are harbingers of future victimization as well. So the current study, based off of all this sort of background context, tested a mindfulness-based cognitive skill-building intervention that was designed to train homeless youth to better detect risk through focusing attention to these three types of cues that I mentioned through the qualitative interviews, some of which are internal, one's own physiological responses and cognitions to a situation, the interpersonal, what are other people doing that seems creepy or off or just doesn't seem right, and then environmental cues, just being in an unfamiliar place, which homeless youth often are because of transience, just being unfamiliar, something's dark or scary or isolated. And this intervention that I'm discussing here is actually an adaptation from the Healthy Adolescent Relationship Project, which was administered by Dr. Anda Prince. She was on the title slide. She's with the University of Denver Psychology Department. And this was a very overlapping, but not exactly the same population that the HARP was administered in. It was actually adolescent girls who were in residential treatment and foster care sorts of settings, but a lot of overlap, and we thought that we could adapt this for homeless youth accordingly. So our research questions: A, was the intervention successful in increasing homeless youth's overall risk detection abilities, and if so, which specific types of risk detection were improved? And this, I don't know how easy that is to read, but that's our flow through the study. We had 97 homeless youth who agreed to join our study at baseline. They were randomly assigned to intervention group, which was the three-day intervention, which I'll talk about more, plus shelter services as usual. And then the other group was the control condition, just shelter-based services as usual. And they were recruited from a drop-in shelter in Denver that's called Urban Peak. It's a 40-bed drop-in shelter. And we lost, unfortunately, about a third of youth between the time that they were assigned for intervention to actually coming to the intervention 4 days later. So that brought our sample down from 56 who were assigned to intervention down to 38. And then we did, following the three-day intervention, a post-test of all remaining control and intervention youth, and our sample ended up being 74, 37 evenly in each group. So usually the reasons that people didn't continue, there were a few who voluntarily just said, I don't want to do your study. Much rarer, though, than actually youth who were hospitalized due to illness in that time frame, or incarcerated, or just had other major life events come up. We actually had fewer people who said that they just didn't want to participate. So a little bit about our sample demographics. Average age was 19. Average months homeless was a little over a year, 15 months. Demographically, pretty racially and ethnically diverse. A majority male, almost two-thirds of the sample. And then in terms of sexual orientation, 78-79% identified as straight or heterosexual, and with the next highest category being self-identifying as bisexual at 13%. So a little context for who we were interviewing. The intervention itself was provided in a group format with 6 to 8 youth per group, and this was done on a staggering basis every 6 weeks or so at the shelter, so we could account for shelter turnover, new youth coming into the shelter, since a lot of youth moved in and out of services frequently. The group itself met for 3 consecutive days, and the activities included discussions, experiential exercises, and as well as didactic materials. To try to target the different executive functioning processes that prior literature had identified as being important or potentially malleable in risk detection. So some of the components of the intervention, it was very important to teach youth about the consequences of previous violence and abuse, and the importance of the concept of being on autopilot. So I equate this in my personal life, where I'm driving somewhere and I realize I have no idea what I was just doing for the last 10 minutes. Like, probably not that safe, but I get somewhere and it's like, well, I clearly was driving here, but I don't remember it. And that's even more dangerous, maybe not, but it's even more dangerous when living on the streets, because if you're just kind of in this tunnel vision autopilot, you miss all of these cues that are going on around you. So we're teaching them more about reframing that as, here's active pilot, what's risky, no, that's not a normal thing, like, take note if you see this kind of thing. So going through examples of that, focusing attention to all of those internal, interpersonal, and environmental cues. Again, what's going on inside of you, what's going on with respect to people around you, and then what is just kind of creepy about the environment that you're in. And then what to do about that, figuring out how to problem solve, how to ask for help, how to be assertive, especially in environments that are new, which is often the case, especially with transients and moving to a different city or a different part of a city. These are all particularly important things. So to measure risk detection, we had these vignettes that were embedded in our intervention. And these were adapted from the original HARP model. And we had 12 different vignettes that we would randomly assign. A youth would go through 2 different vignettes at the first interview, and then a different 2 when we talked to them a week later. And as an example, I would read them something like, Julie meets some guys on the street who invite her to this fun party. When Julie first gets there, she notices there are hardly any girls, but assumes more will come. Several guys come up and give her alcohol, telling her to drink more and more. She thinks the guys are just being friendly, and one guy named Joey has been very forward, constantly putting his arm around her waist and telling her how pretty she is. Joey then asks many personal questions, like how many boyfriends she's had and whether he's her type. Julie's not used to all the attention and doesn't know how to respond. Joey asks her if she wants to stay the night at his place. Julie just likes him as a friend but really needs a place to sleep. So as you can see in the yellow, those are some of the red flags that could or should come up in this situation. And we would ask you at the end of reading some of these vignettes, like what seemed dangerous or unsafe about that situation. And we developed a code book so we could standardize how many cues there really were, what kind they were, and how much we agreed as coders. And then we would take the number of cues that were identified by the youth as a percentage of those that were actually embedded, and then separate them out also into those three subgroups, so internal, interpersonal, and environmental again. And what we found overall, risk detection improved significantly with a moderate to large effect size in the intervention group, but not the control. Meaning that maybe this intervention was onto something, this might be a malleable sort of concept that we can actually teach risk detection to youth through this intervention. And then when we broke it down into the specific types of risk, interpersonal skills, that's the other people around you, the intervention group improved significantly, again, a moderate effect size, whereas in terms of interpersonal cues, the control group actually decreased in their accurate ability to name these. Environmental cues, there was an improvement in intervention assigned youth, but it was not significant. And then in internal cues, there was no improvement, in fact, flat in the intervention group, while there was a slight but not significant improvement in the control group who received no treatment. So that brings us to some limitations. The intervention does seem promising in improving service-seeking homeless youth's ability to detect risks on the street, but that begs the question of those who are not seeking any services, i.e. not going to a shelter, not having case management, who are probably the most at risk of victimization. How do we intervene? How would we possibly offer this kind of intervention to that group? And then future iterations of this intervention should work to improve, obviously, the ones that weren't significant, the internal environmental cues. And one thing I do want to point out is another limitation associated with that. Then environmental cues didn't have there weren't as many possible cues to identify in those vignettes. So a given vignette might only have two or three environmental cues possible to name, whereas there might be 8 or 10 interpersonal and internal. So if someone missed the 1 or 2 or 3 environmental cues that were there, they got a 0%, and it looks like maybe they were really not good at identifying environmental. Or if they got one, it looked like, oh, I got all the environmental ones when it was only a few. So our future iterations of this, which this was a pilot, and we're actually continuing on with this work to do bigger and better and refined versions of it, we will be changing the vignettes, and I think also using more input from the youth themselves to help us craft more realistic situations, because this was adapted from specifically female adolescents in foster care, and I think there could be some different situations that might be more salient to homeless youth. So the better the stories, or the more it looks like their daily lives, I think the better measure it would be of their actual risk detection. This is great, but we don't know if it actually ultimately prevents victimization in the future. So we're working on the mechanism to try to improve their risk detection, but we don't know if this actually over time really changes their experiences of victimization. So that's something that needs to get studied, and at this point is a limitation, but hopefully this leads to work that says, no, it does work over time, and there's utility in doing this. And then, of course, working with this population, attrition is just a fact. It's tricky, and as such, intent to treat analyses are sometimes hard. We start talking in statistics world about type 2 error, and with this, we intended to do an ITT sort of analysis, but since it was a pilot, we wanted to see if there was any trend that emerged. So we actually just looked at this as intervention assigned youth who went through with the intervention as a comparison to control youth. But there is a whole group of people who are not accounted for then in these analyses who were assigned an intervention but who didn't receive it. So generalizability of effectiveness for those folks who just didn't show up for whatever reason. So again, big thank you to Urban Peak, our local source of data and amazing service provider to homeless youth. We had a big research team, and then we had an awesome clinical team who helped us to conceptualize as well as deliver the actual intervention. So we'll do questions later. I think that's
it. A little early.
Yeah. Yeah, I can take a few questions now if we have time. Sure.
I was wondering, did I have to listen to the stories, or did I have to read them?
We were in person, so we had them printed very largely on a binder so they could follow along and read it as well as just listen. So it kind of accounted for differences in reading ability, but those who are visual learners who have the ability to read really well, and that could even be a limitation, just how we process things, audio versus visual and reading ability. We tried to account for that as much as possible, but I would read it, or other administrators of this would read it, but they would have the ability to follow along. And because I can't, I wouldn't be able to do it audio. I'd have to see it personally, but that's how my brain works.
Consider using videos next time? Would that be any different?
Well, I think to do this longitudinally, which this was part of a bigger longitudinal trial, so we're kind of talking about the risk detection pre to post here, but in looking at how to stay in touch with this population longer term itself, because we use technology, we use cell phones, we used Facebook to stay in touch, which isn't included in this part here. But that gets really hard because something over the phone, I can't hear, there are distractions. So I think there's a lot of utility in using things like Skype or Google Hangout, where you can still, mobile case management, I think there's a lot of promise in doing that too, where you can still and kind of connect visually with people, but then not necessarily have to be there, given that this population often moves. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Good question. Others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really helpful to me. Thank you, first of all.
Good, thank you.
So this was a 3-day intervention, right?
Yes.
And you just did you do pre-post, like really pre and post?
Yeah.
Like right after the 3 days?
Yes.
So did you look at any behavioral indicators or like observational measures?
It wasn't.
See whether it's valid as far as predicting actual behavior in the situation.
That's where I think this is limited, because this is a series of standardized instruments. You know, we asked all, you know, at baseline, things like substance use, mindfulness. Mindfulness was one indicator that there is an adopted scale for. So their knowledge of mindfulness and how they identify with that at pre versus learning about mindfulness, that would be one behavioral indicator that we were actually able to measure at post, but not as much as I think could be added. I think this was just sort of a how do scores compare, how do the vignettes help, but to observe what's going on in daily life, there could be benefits in doing that.
Can I ask one more?
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you think could be modified to be an ongoing part of drop-in programming or mm-hmm. shelter service? And do you think that this could be adapted to be taken out through street outreach?
I think that's the group who needs this exposure the most. I mean, it would have to be adapted, because I'm thinking about some of the modules we used. You know, one was how do these different music clips make you feel? So there'd be like this very intense classical, like makes you feel angry kind of music, and then there'd be like a tranquil, you know, Bach kind of thing, like this makes you feel calm. So you have to think about ways to adapt the way just that some of the modules are offered to a way that would be mobile. You could take them out, and videos, and we used a lot of media in the actual intervention modules. But if that can, I mean, like all other technology, it's getting more and more mobile, so I think it'd be possible. We just had to be creative in how we could go do that in more off-the-grid kinds of settings. Yeah.